and welcome to episode 48 of season 11 of Move Around Midnight, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is Dana Nachman, a documentary filmmaker, producer, director, editor, everything. She does everything all herself. I don't know why, but I guess she likes it. Welcome back to the show, Dana.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes, yes. I always love having you on the show because you give me a completely different perspective of things than I usually see them, because you look at them from a filmmaker's perspective and I look at them as a film lover's perspective. So, slightly different.
Yes.
You know, but
we're both.
Yeah, of course. It's great. So episode 48 begins with the men charging across the field and ends with the bull trying to crawl for safety. So what is your background with Band of Brothers, Dana?
Well, actually, I had never seen it before this, believe it or not.
Ooh, that's so nice to hear that I'm able to force/convince people to watch it.
I know. And I'm not like a huge war movie person in general, but I tend to, you know, this is so stellar. It's really, really good. I love it. I just think it's funny that you gave me a completely like war scene, battle scene.
It's random. I didn't look at the scenes and say, oh, these are perfect for Dana. It's
because there's other ones that are more like plot driven, or you know what I mean, or character driven. Mm-hmm. But of course, I did not get that.
Well, I asked you at the beginning what you wanted, and you said I haven't seen it, so give me whatever, and that's what you. You know, that's why I call it dealer's choice. You know, it's like,
yes, exactly.
And for me, it's completely random. You know, I said, okay, yeah. I have 3 slots open here. Let's give them to Dana. It's like, I don't even look at what is going on those 3 episodes.
Yeah. It's hard to do logistics, which is a big part of filmmaking also.
Exactly.
But I really do appreciate, not that it's my scenes, but I love the documentary interviews at the top of every episode. So I love that. And I think it's a really interesting way to ground the episodes.
Yes.
Very cool. And they do that, you know, they kind of bookend it with that plus little stats at the end of each episode talking about the realities.
Right.
Of
right.
That,
even though 2 out of the 3 stats you've seen at the end are completely fictional. So that's.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Why is that?
So for the end of number 2, it talks about the fact that, you know, they teach Dick Winters' maneuvers at Britancourt Manor in West Point. And I've talked to a historian who said that you know, he's gone through the books over the last 80 years and there's not a single course that was taught. They don't mention Dick Winters with it.
That's bad.
Yes.
Now that calls into question my liking that part. We know that AI wasn't around when this was made, so that we know that at least the documentary stuff is real. So
yeah, no. Well, I mean, again, it's facts that they got wrong.
And wow.
The second thing they got wrong is that Blythe did not die in 1948. He continued in the army and died like 20 years later.
Wow.
Yes.
Those seem really like fact checkable. Yeah, that's very, mm-hmm. very weird.
That is very true. And I've, you know, in a few, I think by the end, at the end of this month, I'm going to release an interview that I did with one of the head writers of Band of Brothers. And he talks about the fact that, you know, these things happen.
Wow. You know,
when you're dealing with something so big and there's so many small facts that are being thrown around, and nobody flags it along the way, you reach a point that there's no turning back. You know, once you have it there, you can't change it.
And that's crazy. I mean, just from a perspective of, I do these things a lot, I'm like, that seems like a mess. It's like akin to, remember when the Starbucks cup was on Game of Thrones? It's kind of akin to that.
Okay, exactly. And I mean, there's 2 other big ones that I've also discussed. One is that Liebgott is not Jewish. He was not Jewish.
But, oh, really?
But, you know, in the series, they make him Jewish and they make him get offended when he's, you know, called all these different derogatory names. And,
yeah.
You know, you haven't seen it yet, but there are scenes later that his Jewishness is clear with certain things that happen. But again, Liebgott was not Jewish.
Did they do that like on, I mean, I don't know how much of this whole thing is fictionalized, but did they do that for, you know, just to create tension?
No,
there's a lot of tension.
No,
they made a mistake.
They messed up.
Oh,
they didn't realize that he wasn't Jewish. You know, they said the name Liebgott sounds Jewish. So, okay, he's the Jew. And he wasn't.
Wow.
And the fourth thing that they got wrong is that George Luz apparently was illiterate and didn't know how to read, but they give him, you know, things that he's reading off to people.
Wow. Interesting. You know,
those are the four big ones that I found. But again, it's still very enjoyable to watch this miniseries, totally. Even knowing that information. In some ways, it even enhances the fact, because you think about it and you say, oh, this is just so cool that, you know, there's so much going on. And okay, they miss things. Yeah, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Nobody believe. I mean, this is, as you said, this is not a documentary. So there is stuff that goes on here that didn't really happen. You know, there are a lot of things that happen here that are one line in the book, and they expand on it. You know, so great the way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's always an interesting thing. Is, you know, and this is cool that you're doing this because you can see the realities of where they're breaking from truth, or where they're, you know, where they're fictionalizing it. And that's always interesting, you know, which parts you do and which parts you don't. I mean, mistakes are different, but I think it's interesting.
Right. But these are factual mistakes. It's not just, it's not like the Starbucks thing that you mentioned before. It's, or the fact that in, what was it? I think in the Ten Commandments, they have someone with a watch, you know, in one of the scenes.
Right. Yeah, it just seems like if it's fiction, you could do something like make one of the characters Jewish, because that, you know, you could see why somebody would do that.
Exactly.
But, you know, it's interesting. Like, you know, that's why we have insurance called errors and omissions insurance.
Oh, really? I didn't know there's really something like that. Meaning if someone sues you because you made said something was factual when it's not. And then you have insurance that can pay that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm actually having to buy one today. We do it. You know, you tend to, you know, you budget for it. And as soon as it's going to come out, you bind the policy. Yep.
I'm in complete shock. I did not know this.
Yep. You learn something new every day.
Apparently. You know, I know that these type of things happen, but so the idea is that if you screw up and someone wants to sue you and says, let's even bring an example from here. Someone in Blythe's family says they messed up and, you know, I want to sue you. And then to the insurance then pays the, you know, pays off the, you know, the fact that you're being sued.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like, knock on wood, I've never been sued. So I don't know exactly how
it's. Because you're a perfect documentarian, so there you go.
No. I mean,
what, the dogs are going to sue you? Come on.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be, like, you have to do all your, like, I'm, you know, you have to do all your legal stuff also. And then actually for E&O, you have to prove that a lawyer has gone through all of your, to get to bind the policy. But I don't know if and when it holds up or how it holds up. But often you have to prove that you have the insurance to sell the film.
Oh, wow.
Also, yeah.
It's me. I never even thought about it. I mean, I love going through the IMDb trivia and goofs message things, but I never thought about the fact that you know, people actually will sue. For these type of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to prove, you know, obviously you can't sue for anything, but if you prove that it hurt you and harmed you in any way, then, you know, you see if it holds up. And I don't know. And actually, to be honest, I don't know any of my, knock on wood, my filmmaking friends who have had to use their E&O policies. That's what it's called for short, you know.
Right. Okay. I'm very happy to hear that, you know. You know, but I think that's the whole thing about insurance. It doesn't matter what type of insurance, whether you're getting, you know, home insurance, whether you're getting car insurance, whether you're getting health insurance. It's you want to say at the end of the day that you just threw away this money. You'd be happy to know that you paid this money and therefore you never need to have to worry about it ever again. Yeah,
exactly.
I can understand that. It makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, so for our films, we have to get two big kinds of insurance, E&O and production insurance, and that covers if somebody trips over one of our cords on our shoots, it pays for that, pays for everything.
Someone
That that's
on the set, or someone who's just
yeah.
who's not supposed to be there that shows up, or both.
Probably both. Probably both.
Meaning, if you trip on a cord, then you have insurance that'll pay for your medical bills. If I show up on your set and I trip, that same insurance will pay for that too. You don't have to
I
like
think so.
separate insurance for that.
I'm not totally sure, but I think so. I think anybody, you can't really get in unless somebody invites you, like if I invited you just to watch,
Okay,
then
true. Well, I'm sure there are people that sometimes find ways to get in, but.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I would think that their production insurance for this was very high because of all the stunts and running, and that's it. And it does relate to how aggressive of a shoot it is, or how risky it is.
That's true. Well, all right, very cool. You see, I learned something new today. I'm very happy about that. Okay.
Thanks.
See,
No
that's why
problem.
it's so much fun talking to you, Dana. I
Thank you.
learned things about the filmmaking business that I never even thought about.
Yeah, and that's not even that's like the worst parts, right? Insurance and
Exactly.
lawsuits. Yep.
Exactly. The only lawsuits I've heard is, people say that it's you stole my idea and stuff like that. Not
Yeah.
and
Yeah.
most of those are usually settled out of court in the end, because they basically
Yeah.
say, all right, the movie came out. We'll pay you of X. Don't
Yeah.
bother us
Yeah.
anymore. Yeah, that type
Yeah.
of thing.
Yes.
All right. So basically, we ended yesterday with the men getting ready to run into the town, and because the lieutenant had just gotten shot.
Right.
They thought they were out for a little picnic, and then Lieutenant Brewer gets shot, and basically, for lack of a better phrase, it does hit the fan. So these
Yeah.
guys are all just start running towards the town, getting ready to take out whatever opposition there is in the town itself.
Right.
And so it starts off with them all basically running for cover by the buildings. We see a transport that's still on fire. We see men hiding in ditches, basically,
Right.
which I guess it's good that they were in. They were in Holland at the time, because there are a lot of ditches here.
Yeah.
And then we get a shot of Bull with some of the other men, and we see his new recruits are with him. And Hashi comes running around with Miller, and Hashi then sees a German and screams "Kraut!" and aims to go shoot at him, and his gun jams. So he tries to clear the chamber, and it still doesn't work, and he just screams out. And Bull is no nonsense here, and just screams at him and goes, "God damn it, move. Go, come out, come out." And these guys are all just trying to get closer and stay as covered as possible as they can. We have even a bunch of guys, including Webster, that hide behind a hay truck or a hay Oh, hey, wagon, not even a truck. And Webster is just looking up, and someone then opens a window, and we see this elderly Dutch couple that starts screaming to them, "Away, away, 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 away." I think it's a very funny scene, the way that they do this. And then the guy next to I think it's Van Klinken, then says to Webster, he goes, "What's he saying?" And Webster, we'll find out later, Webster is one of the translators. And he goes, "Well, he said away, away," which either means that the Germans have gone or he wants us to go. I don't
Yeah, I
know.
thought that was funny.
They're in the middle of this thing. You don't know whether the people of Holland want them to stay or not, that type of thing. So it's an interesting way to look at things, and they give us the various perspectives on the whole thing.
Well,
So
they just
it's
had that whole scene of them all being so happy they were there.
yes, of course, but
Yeah.
again, not everyone's going to always act the exact same way.
Right.
You will have people that'll be happy, and you'll have others that will be less happy.
Right.
And then we see a few of the men run up to one of the houses, getting ready to go inside, and we then one of the men after they break into the house. So the next group come to go into the next house next to them. We see a bunch of guys jumping over the wall, which for anyone who's ever seen police or war or military training movies, you know, not like documentaries, meaning like movies where we see the men learn how to, you know, train and stuff like that. They always have like this wall that they have to get over. And yeah. Here's a perfect example as to why you need to train beforehand to get over a wall, because you will be in a place like this where you need to get over a wall.
Right.
And therefore, it's good that you learned how to do it.
Yeah.
And then Garnier leads his men, and they actually run through a cemetery, which is interesting the way that they have them do that. And they reach the edge of the cemetery, and we can see in the background that there are a few tanks that are coming up.
Yeah.
And then Garnier gets to the edge of one of the buildings, and he sees it's Ramirez, and he goes, "Ramirez!" And then he lets him know that he's there, and they're getting ready to move forward into the next thing. And we see that one of the guys who's jumping over the fence actually trips and falls down a little bit. So, you know, again, maybe someone who didn't do his training properly.
Right.
Quite possibly with the way that this all plays out. And then they move forward to the next building to go try and take out that building. And they're all standing at the edge of the building getting ready for it. Buck is getting ready. He runs from a different perspective, from a different side, and he also he jumps over a low brick wall with his men. And again, we can see that the tanks in the background getting closer to them, the ally tanks. And mm-hmm. Buck and his men get their mortars ready in order to shoot it. And he goes, "All right, fellas, set them up." And you know, I like the way how they keep jumping from these various squads, yeah, showing us different aspects of this particular place.
Yeah, I like
you know,
that.
And how they're also working in I don't know if synchronicity is the right word, but they're all working together.
Yeah.
To try to get into a particular position of where they need to do it, and then we see that the Bull goes and he's checking out what's going on, and we see that. We can see a German tank that's camouflaged,
yeah,
along the way, and then they jump to Martin and his squad, and he notices it also, and he goes, "Tiger." He goes, "Oh shit!" And then he calls and he goes, "Heffron, on me!" And the two of them leave everyone else, and they want to go to warn the tanks that are showing up that there is a German tank that's in hiding here. And he says to him, he goes, "Stay low." And the two of them start running towards the tank. And he goes, "You got a can opener, babe?" And he goes, "Afraid I don't, Sarge." And it made me wonder, like, what could they be referring to when they say, "Do you have a can opener?" You know, like, what is a military term of can opener? Any clue?
A grenade?
Well, when you look it up, it is a can opener called a P-38, which is nicknamed the John Wayne. But I don't think that's what they're referring to. You know, I did a search for what is a military term for a can opener.
Uh-huh.
So
I think a grenade.
It probably is a hand grenade. It's a anti-tank gun. Anti-tank
Okay.
Missile. That's what he's referring to.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But it's interesting the way that they the way that he just throws it out like that.
Yeah.
So I like that because again it's something that for them it's ABC. You know, this is the type of stuff that you're going to use, and for us, you know, you hear the song, you hear the you hear him say this slang, and you're like, okay, well, what could he be referring to?
Right.
It's an anti-tank munition or an attack vehicle that will open up an armor like a tin can. So okay, it makes sense.
Yeah.
That they would refer to it that way. Basically, an anti-tank missile that is what he's looking for. And
how big it is?
Absolutely no clue. probably larger than a real can opener. That much I would give you.
Yeah.
And then Babe says, "Afraid I don't, Sarge." And he goes, and then they reach the tank, and he climbs up on top, and bang, you know, he starts talking to the commander of the tank, who we can tell by his accent that he's British, and he goes, "We've got a Kraut tank 100 yards on the left by the haystack. I don't see him." He goes, "Put a couple of shells through that building. You're going to see him real good." He goes, "I can't. My orders are to are no unnecessary destruction of property." He goes, "I'm telling you, he's right there." And he goes, "And I believe you. But if I can't see the bugger, I can't bloody hell won't shoot him, can I?" And he just continues moving forward. And then he turns to Martin and he goes, "Are you staying or going?" And then Martin just decides that he's not sticking around there, and he gets down off of the tank. So this whole conversation is really interesting from the perspective that, you know, sometimes when soldiers are in the middle of a battle or a maneuver or whatever, they, you know, the whole idea of rules of engagement, of what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do and stuff like that. And in this particular situation, you know, here's a tank that is going into a situation where they know there will be another tank that's going to attack them. And because of their orders, they can't do that. They can't do anything until they actually are shot upon, you know, that type of thing. So sometimes the logic in these type of situations is a little screwy, I guess you can say.
Mm-hmm.
But I did like the fact that, you know, at the end, the commander of the tank said, "Well, if I can't see him, I can't shoot him."
Yeah.
So there is something to that also. It's not, I'm just going to, you know, shoot into random places. If I could see him, I would shoot him. You know, but there's also the other perspective that if I can't see him, he can't see me.
Right.
Oh, but he can definitely hear you. Yeah. I think that's part of it. You know, Martin gets off and goes, "He's going to see you real soon." And Bull looks at it and is really confused because, you know, they should be stopping. And he goes, "What the hell is he doing?" And then, you know, the tank, the British tank continues. And we see the tank turret of the German move in order to get a clear shot. And then they just shoot it. And Martin just watches helplessly as the tank as the second tank right behind it, the first tank has a direct hit, you know, from this German Panzer. So it's, again, you know, we have a situation here where someone is doing what they can to try and save someone else. But because of the military conduct, there's nothing he can do,
mm-hmm.
you know, that type of thing. So, but I do like the fact that the way that this whole scene is set up is that, you know, when the guy looks in his binoculars, he really can't see anything. You know, everything looks calm and peaceful, even though we know that shortly that is going to change.
Right.
Because we know that there are people that are going to start shooting from the top of the building that's right in front of them, and some from the windows and stuff like that. But everyone is waiting patiently for them to get into the line of fire.
Yeah.
And then once that the second tank is hit, so the tank commander screams, "Forward, roll tank!" And then Bull realizes that they're not in a good situation either, and he says, "Fall back, go! Pull back, take cover, take cover!" And, you know, they're doing all they can to keep their distance from both the tank and the German men that are German soldiers that are starting to shoot at them also. You know, so it's, I like the way that the chaos builds here.
Yeah.
Which is done really well. I mean, I also like the fact that we get to see that this is, you know, a part of the puzzle of Market Garden. You know, so have you ever seen A Bridge Too Far?
No, uh-uh.
Uh-huh. Okay, so A Bridge Too Far is the Richard Attenborough movie from 1977 that depicts this entire mission.
Oh, wow.
Of Market Garden, you know, where they're just a small part of this whole mission, where they were trying to go and capture a whole bunch of bridges, and they were able to get all of them but one, and that's why it eventually, you know, the operation failed, because they just weren't able to make the last one, hence A Bridge Too Far. I love the fact that when they were writing Band of Brothers, they said, "Hey, these guys were part of Operation Market Garden, so why don't we add a segment depicting that?" So at this point, you know, all hell is broken loose because this tank has finally started doing things, and it just opens up fire, and it, you know, it shoots at one of the buildings. We see lots of debris, flying all over the place. Bull gets knocked over by the impact, and his helmet falls off. And he gets up, and he doesn't even pick up his helmet because he just wants to get out of there. And then this chateau that's there, someone just starts opening fire. There's two Germans on the roof that just start opening up fire at the men. I mean, it's a great ambush. There's no question about that, the way that they set this up.
Yeah.
You know, and then Bull is trying to get out of there and runs past the British tank. And the lead British tank then gets hit by the German Panzer. And then the shot changes and the men are all trying to find some cover. And they're just running all over the place. And we see the burning tank moving towards where Bull is, where everyone's looking for some sort of cover with what they're doing. And Buck is there and, you know, returning fire from at the Germans who've now just started to I guess come out of the woodwork, basically, with the way that they're doing all this stuff. It's just we came to this little town thinking that everything is quite peaceful, and here we had a tank that's hiding along with a whole bunch of dozens of soldiers. They're all there ready to start firing at them, and Bull just keeps crawling as this burning tank with the guy who, you know, we just talked about, was being warned.
Yeah. You think that when the old couple did that, they were trying to warn, I think they were trying to warn them, right?
I think so. I think that's what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
But why would they say away, away, away? Meaning that there's no way that you're going to be able to do this. So, hide.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you'd think that the warning would be prepared or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I would think a little more, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think they were just trying to warn them.
Yeah. But again, they do a great job of showing how, these one of the things I like about this miniseries is that none of the battles are the same as the battles beforehand. Meaning they showed us the battle, you know, when we're the two battles of Carrington, you know, when they're in the town and then when they're out of the town, and they're shot in completely different ways, and they don't even look like they're in the same vicinity, even though it's not specifically the exact same place, but not the same vicinity. And then here, once again, they're in a different town, and everything is being shown from another different perspective. Which, again, I think this is just really cool, the way that they're doing this in order to show us that, it's not as if a battle is something that can be taken from a stereotype or, you know, there's no blueprint of how the battle needs to go. Every battle is going to be different.
Right.
You know, so I like the way that they show that to us.
Yeah, it's really cool on how, you know, I like each of the different perspectives and the fast cuts. It's really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can really feel as if you're there with these guys, mm-hmm. with the way that they're all running back and forth, trying to stay as safe as possible. I guess pretty interesting the way that they show this to us.
Yeah, it's a really good scene.
Yeah. And as Bull is still trying to crawl away, that's where this 5-minute segment ends. So is there anything else you wanted to mention about this particular segment?
No, I just really liked, kind of, there's a lot of setup and payoff in it, you know, in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, the discussion about the tank. And so you know what's going to happen, so you're just waiting for it to happen. I think that was really good. And the same with the elderly couple preparing them, like there's, you know, in that chunk, there just is constant setup and payoff. I like that.
Right. I mean, again, the book, it talks about everything that's going on here, but it just has, it's abridged, I guess you can say.
Yeah.
You know, what it basically says here on page 99 of the book is, it says the 107th Panzer Brigade stationed in Helmand was attacking west towards Neunen with some 50 tanks, more than we had ever seen at one time, Winters recalled. Sergeant Martin saw a German tank almost hidden in a fence row about 100 meters away. A British tank was coming up. Martin ran back to it, climbed aboard, and told the commander there was an enemy tank just below and to the right. The tank continued to move forward. Martin cautioned the commander that if he continued his forward movement, the German tank would soon see him. I can't see him, old boy, the commander replied, and if I can't see him, I can't very well shoot at him. And he goes, you'll see him damn soon, Martin shouted as he jumped out and moved away. The German tank fired. The shell penetrated the British tank's armor. Flame erupted. The crew came flying out of the hatch. The gunner pulled himself out last. He had lost his legs. The tank, now a flaming inferno, continued to move forward on its own, forcing Bull Randleman to move in the direction of the enemy to avoid it. A second British tank came forward. It too got blasted. Altogether, four of the British tanks were knocked out by the German 88s. The two remaining tanks turned around and began to move back to, into Neuden. Easy Company fell back with them. So, you know, it's great how they're able to take this paragraph and a half and tell us so much more about this story. I love the way that the writers are able to expand on this, and it doesn't feel as if it's different than what was written here.
Right. It's so cool. I love it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Me too. All right. So today's segment is called Band Brand, where my guests will give their top five fictional movie bands. So Dana, why don't you start off with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, but I did movies and TV shows. I hope that's okay.
It's not, but I already know. I already know you, so that's fine. I wouldn't have expected anything different from you.
Okay, great. Okay, so number five is Sing Street from the movie of the same name.
Mm-hmm.
Number four is The Partridge Family.
Yeah, I pretty much assumed that was where you were going with the TV show.
Number three is Spinal Tap. Number two is Stillwater from, do you want me to tell you what, do you know what movie that's from?
It's from Almost Famous.
Yes, good. And number one is The Brady Bunch.
I knew that was going to be on your list. I was getting prepared to say to you, Dana, I can't believe you don't have Brady Bunch on your list.
Oh, well, I would.
Yes, you do. I will. All right. So now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie, where I will randomly give you the name of some hints, and you have to try and guess the World War II movie.
No, I'm never going to know it because I don't watch World War II movies.
Maybe. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. Okay, this is a movie from 2006, and it is Clint Eastwood's companion piece to Letters from Iwo Jima. Does that help you? So you know that that he did Letters from Iwo Jima from the Japanese perspective, and then he did one from the American perspective about the men who lifted up the flag.
God, I didn't.
Does that help?
I didn't see either of them.
You know, it's a good thing they don't let you vote at the Oscars. No, I'm kidding.
If this was the rom-com section, I would know it. I think.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Serendipity. The answer is Flags of Our Father.
Gotcha.
That's it. By your answer, I know that you've never even heard of it, but that's okay.
I have heard of that, actually, but I haven't seen it.
Let's put it this way. It's not as good as Letters from Iwo
Jima. Okay, so you would start with Letters, if I was going to watch one.
Yes.
What do you give that as from a 0 out of 10?
Letters, I give a 10.
Okay, all right.
And Flags of Our Fathers, I give like a 6 or a 7.
Okay.
No, it's not as powerful.
All right, well then I'll check it out.
But again, Clint Eastwood is an amazing filmmaker.
Yeah, you know. Agreed.
And you know the way that he just jumps from genres is amazing.
Yeah.
But from what I understand, he's not making any more. But we'll have to wait and see.
Yes. Definitely.
All right. So Dana, would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
Sure. I have a website. It's justmyname.com, DanaNachman, DanaNachman.com.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, MovieAroundMinute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to MovieAroundMinute@MovieAround.net. So, until tomorrow, hurry!
Hurry!